by 9 of the young librarians, the aides who work for the library. They are going to reenact our demonstration, and we would have a DVD commemorating that event. Although I couldn't make it because, you know, I have glaucoma, and I wrote and told her, you know, the reason why I would be unable to make it, and she sent me my medallion and a copy of the DVD in the mail. And that's how I became connected again to the history of the Tougaloo Nine. I mean, it was you call it fate, the Zeitgeist, destiny, whatever you want to call it. All I know, you know, it happened, and then now here you are. You know what I mean? So I you know, this is an awe-inspiring moment for me, and I have no control over what really has transpired with regards to the history of the civil rights history of the Tougaloo Nine.
Well, on that note, thank you for your actions that day on March 27, 1961. And also thank you very much for sharing your story and your struggle with our listeners here today.
My pleasure.
KABU Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KABU in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KABU Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kabu.fm. Due to the temporary closure of in-station activity at KABU, meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available on our website. The Engineering Committee meets on the first Thursday of the month at 7 p.m. Please visit our website at kabu.fm to verify if a meeting is...
This is Medea Benjamin. I hope you listen to Community Radio KBOO 90.7.
Welcome back to Row on the Rocks, a limited series podcast about what abortion access looked like in America in the months leading up to the U.S. Supreme Court overturning Roe. Last time on the show, I spoke with Julie Edwards, the Patient Advocacy Programs Manager for Planned Parenthood of Tennessee and Northern Mississippi, about their work elevating the stories of patients who for years were already living in a post-Roe America. In our conversation that took place back in April of this year, just months before Roe would be overturned by the U.S. Supreme Court, we took a look at the many barriers in place for patients trying to access abortion services in Tennessee. Here's a quick look back on our conversation.
We were already in an access crisis. Like, a post-Roe world was already a reality for so many, like, people and communities of color and low-income folks and undocumented people. And so there are people who have been living in a post-Roe world. Basically, like, there's no need to make accessing an abortion any harder than it already is, because it's already not a reality for so many people because they can't swing the, you know, like double the time off work, or because of like staffing issues. I've heard a lot of patient stories talking about the 48-hour waiting period where they'll say like, I came in for my first appointment. I really needed my second appointment to be within like a 48 to 72 hour window because of where I was in the pregnancy, how many weeks pregnant I was. And because of staffing issues, that second appointment ended up being 2 weeks later. And that pushed me from a medical abortion over the gestational limit threshold to having to have a surgical abortion. And the difference in cost for those things is a matter of sometimes upwards of $1,000.
Today, I'm sharing the second part of my conversation with Julie Edwards as they dig deeper into the many barriers for marginalized communities trying to access abortion services in Tennessee.
So in a lot of the organizing that we do with, especially I'm really thinking of like the Black or Latinx communities here in Nashville specifically, so much of our work in those communities is focused on providing them a sort of like mutual aid resource around reproductive health care, because so many are determined not to enter into the healthcare setting because the healthcare setting is so deeply racist, and they know that, you know, if they were to go seek out that care, that they wouldn't be listened to by providers, that they wouldn't be taken seriously. And then also, if you look at like Black maternal health mortality rates in childbirth, you know, like people are well aware of that. And
it's much higher than it goes for white folks.
Yeah, much, much more.
Right.
And they're aware of that in their communities in a way that, like, it's really easy for us as white people to see that as a statistic and be scared by that. For Black people, it is a lived reality. And so a lot of them decide to take healthcare into their own hands because they don't want to enter into a space that is going to treat them inhumanely and not take their health seriously, and rightfully so. So a lot of our efforts are around providing them information about how to take it into their own hands and how to, you know, provide sexual and reproductive health care for themselves and for their communities, like outside of abortion too. And so it looks a lot more like community care and like mutual aid than, you know, meeting them in the health center. So at our Nashville Health Center, we do see predominantly like people of color at our location, more so than white folks. And it's really important to us in the work that we do to uplift those experiences and to talk about what the barriers look like for people of color and not just white people, because the lived experiences are completely different and they're touched by, you know, different systems of oppression that white people will never know or never experience. And you can't ignore how those overlap and interact with each other, because it becomes not just a barrier to care. It becomes one more aspect of the systemic racism that you face every day.
And can you explain that a little bit more specifically? Like, are we talking about economic disparities, education, healthcare, insurance?
Yeah. So, yeah, I do think it comes down to a lot of like who is able to access that care. So barriers for people of color, communities of color, look a lot more like, you know, financial or economic, needing financial or economic support for their abortion services. Whereas like the wealthy, affluent white people who come see us aren't as concerned about whether or not they'll be able to afford their surgical abortion. And then outside of that, it is also, yeah, for a lot of people, coming into a healthcare setting is scary because not only do you not have insurance, but if you're undocumented and you don't have an ID, we can't see you for an appointment. And so for a lot of people, like, accessing abortion through, like, traditional healthcare settings just isn't a reality for them. It's not feasible. And those are the kind of stories that we're hearing. People who aren't able to get abortions because the barriers to that care, like, are so great, they don't want to put themselves or their families at risk.
And then you mentioned for people who come in and they are undocumented, so they don't have issued ID. Can you talk about, is it that you just legally can't provide, you know, obviously you can't see them, but can you provide them any additional information or resources that another entity could help them with?
Yeah, that goes back to that, like, mutual aid or community care piece that I mentioned before, especially in our, like, Latinx organizing. We are really, really good. Our organizers are really good about being in that community and making themselves well known as a community resource. And so our community resources, or our efforts to provide, like, a mutual aid infrastructure in those communities so that they're still being taken care of. And our health center staff are really good about making sure that if we have to turn anyone away in the health center, that they still get connected to our advocacy efforts, because that's not the last stop. You know, like, there are definitely other things that we can do for them or resources we can provide for them outside of our health center.
For sure. And then I want to go back to something that you mentioned, that, you know, since the beginning of healthcare in the United States, there has been rampant racism. How do the staff and healthcare providers at the Planned Parenthood that you work at address that history? And what kind of training goes into being mindful of that when working with patients of color?
Yeah, I'm really, really glad that you asked. So anyone who gets hired with us has to go through, like, a cultural competency intensive training, and as well as, like, a diversity in the workplace. And they're encouraged to have conversations whenever they first get hired in their cohort around, like, the history of medical racism, especially in, like, reproductive health care settings. So they are armed with this knowledge and with the skills to try to combat that before they ever see any of our patients. And while we work really hard to make sure that that information that they're receiving sets them up for success so that we don't repeat the cycle of, like, racism in our healthcare settings, like, we can always be doing more. And I'm sure that there are, you know, like, instances where we haven't done everything perfectly, but I do know that, like, our healthcare staff, they, like, each and every single patient that they see, they go above and beyond for that patient. You know, it's almost like, you know, that patient is their only patient in the moment, and, like, the only thing that they care about, and they want to really make sure that they're taking good care of these people. I actually, this isn't related to abortion specifically, but we actually do provide a lot of postnatal care too. And many of the, like, Black women or Black mothers that I have the experience talking to in my line of work say that they opted not to go to their OBGYN for their postnatal care. They opted to come to Planned Parenthood because they knew that the quality of care that they would receive would be better, or because their OB that they were seeing was really racist and didn't take that into account or wasn't taking them seriously, and they wanted to go somewhere where they knew that they would be heard. And that was actually one of the very first stories that I ever heard whenever I got hired, was this Black mother talking about how she was 2 or 3 weeks post-birth and had a tubal ligation at the same time as she gave birth to her son. And in the 2 or 3 weeks afterwards, she wasn't scheduled for a postnatal appointment for like a month after giving birth, just because her doctor didn't have openings. And she knew that something was wrong. Like, she was having end-of-life conversations with her husband. Wow. Because she couldn't get out of bed, she couldn't eat, she couldn't bathe her kids, you know, like, she knew something was wrong. And so she immediately went to Planned Parenthood and found like an infection internally on her tubal ligation site, and she was able to take those ultrasounds and our nurses' like medical advice to the ER, to urgent care, and that saved her life. And so a lot of people talk about how like their doctors didn't take them seriously, and so they needed to go somewhere where they knew that they would be heard. And I'm really, really grateful that that place is Planned Parenthood for a lot of people.
Back in April, when I spoke with Julie Edwards, the fate of abortion access and just how limited it would be if and when Roe fell was still unclear. What was clear was that when Roe would be overturned, 12 trigger law states, including Tennessee, could now go as far as limiting abortion to 6 weeks or even further because of their state trigger laws, bans already on the books that fully or seriously restrict abortion, and could only legally go into effect if the U.S. Supreme Court overturned Roe. And as of this taping just a week ago, on August 25th, Tennessee outlawed nearly all abortions with no exceptions for rape or incest, the only exception being to prevent the death or serious injury of a pregnant person. Now, back to my conversation with Julie Edwards explaining the timeline of anti-abortion legislation that ultimately led to Tennessee's current abortion ban.
So, abortion access is being attacked kind of on all sides right now. So I'll speak to what's happening in Tennessee and then what's happening more so at the Supreme Court level here in just a second. So in Tennessee this year, we saw a copycat of Texas's SB8 law. The way that SB8 functions in Texas is it is a 6-week ban with a bounty hunter provision that states that if someone helped someone procure an abortion, that the helper could be sued by any private citizen. And if their lawsuit was successful, the person would be awarded $10,000 by the state for filing that lawsuit. And so the difference between that piece of legislation and ours that we're seeing here in Tennessee is Texas's is a 6-week ban. The piece of legislation that was pushed forward here in Tennessee is a total ban. So there's no window in which people would actually be able to procure an abortion here. And it does have that same bounty hunter provision where anyone who helps someone else get an abortion can be the target of a lawsuit. And, you know, that's really scary because that targets abortion providers, that targets, you know, people like me who just advocate and give people information, that targets your family, your friends, your partners. And it gives anyone with any sort of like ulterior motive the right to sue. So it could give like sidewalk protesters, abusive partners, like controlling like family in law, you know, like it could give anyone the right to sue you and pursue legal action against you for helping someone else that you love. And then they get $10,000 because of it, you know? So, I mean, it's just really, really terrifying. And then on top of that, there was a medication abortion bill that was being proposed that not so much in its language, but in its function, would essentially make it impossible for you to get mailed abortion pills or seek like telehealth abortion appointments from other states, from providers in other states, and then get like mailed abortion pills here. It would really crack down on those. And basically, what those laws do are to like criminalize pregnancy and enforce pregnancy surveillance. Like, under these laws, every miscarriage would be like suspect to investigation. And that's really horrifying for several reasons that I don't think I have to lay out.
Right.
So we are facing abortion bans on the statewide level, though I do have some updates around those and where they are currently, if you want me to speak to that.
That would be great.
Those
Thank
are
you.
The bills that we're, yeah, those are the bills that we're seeing. Currently, the Texas-style SB 8 bill has been taken off notice in the House Health Committee. So the way that it works here is we have to have a House version of a law and a Senate version of a law, and it has to go through on both sides, the subcommittee level, the committee level, and then it'll go to the full floor. So that law here made it to the House Health Committee, but because of a few different issues that people have taken with the bill, and I like to think because of our advocacy efforts, that bill has been taken off notice, which means they won't be hearing it in the committee for a vote. That doesn't mean we're out of the woods yet, because in Tennessee we have a supermajority. It does mean that whenever the full House floor, the full Senate floor convenes, they could vote to suspend the rules for how the floor functions or for how a bill has to make its way through the legislature, and they could decide to take it up for a vote in with no notice, kind of without it being on any agenda. And, you know, once it's passed by the full House floor, the full Senate floor, both of those, it goes to the governor's desk. So they could kind of decide to bypass all the routes that a bill traditionally needs to take. So we're not totally out of the woods yet, but it is a pretty good sign that it has been taken off of the House Health Committee's agenda.
And that's just for the, I'm just going to call it the Texas copycat law that is even more restrictive than Texas's SB 8 law.
Yeah.
There are, as far as I know, there are other pieces of legislation. Correct me if I'm wrong, but there are other restrictive abortion legislation that could still go into effect if passed.
Yeah, there are other restrictive pieces of legislation. We also are feeling pretty hopeful that the medication abortion bill that is our second topmost concern is also going to be taken off notice. But we also there aren't fully out of the woods just yet. But things are looking promising as of right now in April of 2022.
Okay. And it looks promising because the healthcare committee?
Yeah, it's just the House Health Committee.
Thank you. That's what I thought. The House Healthcare Committee has decided to not move it forward. Is that correct?
Right.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. For the Texas SB 8 bill.
Got it. And so, and then based on that, it sounds like, you know, that's what's also leading you to be hopeful about the telemedicine legislation.
The medication abortion bill has been on the Senate side in the subcommittee and committee level and has not been put on their future agendas, and they're getting to a point now in the legislative session where like their next agenda is their final agenda and it's not listed on there.
Got it.
They probably won't hear it in committee, but they could do the same thing where they decide to like bypass the traditional route for a bill once we get to like the full House and floor sessions, or House and Senate floor sessions. So yeah, we're not totally out of the woods, but things are looking up. But in that same vein, even though we're out of the woods when it comes to like our state legislature and the laws that we're passing, we're facing an even more serious situation when it comes to the Supreme Court and what's going on there. So the Supreme Court is hearing Mississippi's 15-week ban case, and experts say that that does not look good.
Right.
So in Tennessee, we have something called a trigger law, which many other states have too. But the way that our trigger law functions is it says that if Roe is ever overturned on a Supreme Court level, even in part, so let's say they do push it back to a state's rights issue, abortion immediately becomes illegal in Tennessee within 30 days of that passing.
And just to clarify, a lot of places that I will read about trigger laws say that it's a full-out ban of abortion. Some of them, and while I understand this is still heavily restrictive, is that a complete ban or a couple weeks are allowed, say like 6 weeks?
I'm sorry, I couldn't really hear you. Are you asking if the 15-week ban would just be a 15-week ban?
No. Sorry, what I'm saying is, what I just wanted to clarify was that for some states, the language that I will hear is that it's a complete ban on abortion, when the reality is it is heavily restrictive but not fully banned, meaning like in Texas where it is allowable, legal, up to 6 weeks, obviously still very restrictive. So in Tennessee, if the trigger law ban goes into effect because Roe is overturned or a part of that Mississippi law is upheld, will it be a complete ban on abortion? Like, absolutely no weeks allowed.
No, actually.
Okay.
So if our trigger law is enacted because of a Supreme Court decision, we will be at the 15-week level, which is where the case sort of sets like the viability ban at.
Got it. Okay.
So 15 weeks, however, that will give our state legislature grounds to take that even further. There's currently a law that was passed back in 2020. We refer to it as Governor Bill Lee's omnibus abortion ban, and that is a 6-week ban. That's currently in litigation in the courts, so it's not currently in action, but it is already in law. So what they could decide is, since the Supreme Court upheld the 15-week ban, they could decide to like really push like one of our circuit judges to take that out of like litigation, or to allow them to push that forward, and we could see us get moved to a 6-week ban, which again doesn't mean that abortion is completely illegal here. It is just drastically restricted, which is around the same of what we're seeing in Texas with their 6-week ban as well.
And currently, how many weeks is abortion allowed up to in Tennessee?
In Tennessee, abortion is currently allowed up to 20 weeks. Okay. In Nashville specifically, we will provide abortion services up to 19 weeks in 6 states.
So if Roe is overturned by the U.S. Supreme Court, Tennessee's trigger law ban will go into effect within 30 days. And you're saying that the ban will be restricting abortion, so going from 20 weeks to 15 weeks, with the possibility of further restricting that through various legal avenues. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah.
Okay.
Exactly.
Okay, great. And then we've been talking a lot about some very, for anyone who is in favor of keeping abortion in our healthcare system, this is, I'm sure, very upsetting to hear and, you know, hard to hear. I would like to leave on a more hopeful note. And you mentioned that there are various things that are giving you hope, legislatively and otherwise. Can you talk about what are some messages you would like listeners to hear, especially folks in your own home state, and why they shouldn't give up?
I love this question. And I would say to anyone listening, if this scares you, you know, I mean, we are right to be scared, but the people doing this work and the abortion providers that will still help you are incredible people. Like, there is some of the most, like, radical grassroots work being done organizing our communities for a sort of, like, fail-safe way to make sure that people can still get the care that they need. Like, we are building infrastructure that would allow us to, you know, put in place a sort of, like, support line that people could call and say, like, I need an abortion. This is, like, where I am in terms of my weeks of pregnancy. This is what I need help with, whether it's, like, financial care or child care or travel out of state to another state that has, like, less restrictions than we do. And our navigators will help you, like, on a case-by-case basis around, like, getting you whatever it is that you need to get an abortion. So just know that if you need help, help is there, kind of no matter what. There are also, like, legal advocates here that are preparing to be able to take on any of these potential, like, lawsuit cases, because, you know, if we do potentially in Tennessee move to a 6-week ban instead, you know, we're going to see a rise in the amount of lawsuits or the amount of, like, people pressing charges against people who are suspected of, like, going above that 6-week mark. There are legal advocates who are, like, freeing themselves up, who are ready to provide pro bono care, who are ready to walk you through whatever it is that you need. So just know that the resources are there if you need them. I think now is a time where we see how a community comes together in response to this. And